Franklin is president of Tactical Financial Consulting, LLC, in Alpharetta, Georgia. Has more than 25 years of experience and education in complex financial matters. Throughout his career, he gained experience in commercial finance, leasing, lending, real estate, valuation, and restructuring. And prior to forming Tactical Financial in 2005, he was a senior lender at Textron Financial Corporation, was a commercial real estate appraiser with a national appraisal firm, and held various positions with First Florida Bank. He's a member of ABI and co-chair of its Financial Advisors Committee, the Association of Insolvency and Restructuring Advisors, and the Turnaround Management Association, and is an affiliate member of both the CFA Institute and the Appraisal Institute. Mr. Lee received his BS in Management, his MBA from Florida State University. I'll wait. Okay. Any Gators out there that want to be want to give the Seminoles a chance? And also has his master's degree in real estate and urban analysis from the University of Florida. And with that, I'll turn it over to Franklin.
Thank you, Keith. Can we revisit the Florida State thing? Because we're going to revisit it, I promise you. This is our year, and I have not forgotten. I'm going to take advantage of this year, and I'm sure the rest of you will let me know when your year occurs. But we got it for a year. So, with that, thank you for having me. I began my path in bankruptcy with Judge Pasquet, so this particular moment in this conference has a very special place for me. I thought the world of Judge Pasquet, and he taught me an awful lot. So, with that, let's begin. Keith already gave you most of the things. You can pick any two you want to believe. Not all of them are true, but I did go to Florida State. I got my bachelor's degree and my MBA with an emphasis in finance. I went out and I did commercial real estate appraisal work for a little while, and then went and attended the University of Florida. I got a master's in real estate, some order like that. Look at that. Where did that come from? The question I always get is, are you a Gator or are you a Seminole? I just want to clear this up right away. I don't know how that got in that slide there. Okay. So today we're going to go through 1111B. And 1111B is one of the more mysterious pieces of the bankruptcy code. But I want to give you some sense of the history, why we have it, why it exists, and then we'll walk through how it works. And then we're going to spend a fair amount of time on the mathematics today, because I think that's where people tend to get caught up, and not the legal issue so much, although there are some cases that we may talk about as we go through. But it is the math that seems to make most people go, I don't get this. And that's where the pushback comes from. And I think it's important to understand 1111B in the economy we have today, because it really comes into effect when you have rising values in the market. It also, interesting enough, may have some of its most dramatic effects when you have collateral that's depreciating, and we'll talk about that as well. But most people tend to think of 1111B as a tool to use in single asset real estate cases because the number of creditors are few. But as we go through the mathematics, keep your eye out and think about how it would function in terms of a depreciating asset like a piece of equipment or an older piece of real estate. Okay, so why do we have 1111B to begin with? Well, if you go back in time, the Bankruptcy Act, which preceded the Bankruptcy Code, allowed secured creditors, or debtors rather, to value a secured creditor's collateral. And once they did that valuation, it let them pay off the secured creditor with no other claim. So there was no deficiency claim allowed. That was a problem because it encouraged debtors to file bankruptcy when values were low. And it really tipped the scales into the hands of the debtor. So there was a bunch of cases that started bubbling up around the mid-1970s. And the sort of the seminal case is Pine Gate. And Pine Gate was an apartment complex in Atlanta, Georgia. Exactly what I just described happened. Values fell. The debtor came in, valued the mortgage at a particular number, paid off the creditor, values went back up, and all of a sudden, at the expense of the creditor, the debtor had received the windfall. So that was a problem. Congress went to work and installed 1111B into what's the bankruptcy code. And that was sort of a compromise between the two positions, and it allowed the debtors and the creditors, or the creditors rather, some more power in it, so the leverage wasn't all on one side. That said, it interacts with a couple of other pieces of the code which you've got to pay attention to, which are 506 and 1129. And obviously other pieces of the code as well, but those are the two biggies that come into play. Okay, so as I said, we had the Bankruptcy Act where you would only have a secured claim. Bankruptcy Code essentially made bifurcated a secured claim under 506 into a secured piece and an unsecured piece. Oops. So 506, when you look at it, it says essentially you get a secured claim for the value of your interest in your collateral. By the way, why is only Sam Giordano sitting in the front row? Wasn't this riveting that, you know, you won backstage passes or something? So you end up with an unsecured claim as well. And while most of us tend to think of 1111B as important to the secured claim, it probably has some of its most dramatic effects when you're voting your claims and deciding how or if you're going to keep your unsecured claim. So the 1111B statute, what it essentially does is it takes a non-recourse creditor, or allows a non-recourse creditor, to participate as a recourse creditor. So instead of just having recourse back to your collateral, you now transfer that to recourse to the debtor itself. And it's not quite that simple, and it gets broken up, as we'll see in a moment. And then it's an election for the secured creditor's interest. So the secured creditor gets to decide. It's not a choice of the debtor. And there are a few rules, a couple of which are up here. The secured claim can't be of inconsequential value, for example. So it's really got to have meaning to the case. And there are cases that kind of cut both ways, and what does inconsequential value mean is a big question mark. So not only do you try to figure out what the value is that matters, who's the inconsequential value to? Is it to the estate? Is it to the creditor? Is it to the effect to the other creditors who are in the case? It's not very clear. The other big part of this is if you're going to sell the collateral or the property in a 363 sale, 1111B goes away, okay? Because you still, as a secured creditor, would retain your right to credit bid. Okay, so you've got this election. You get to choose. When do you have to do that by? Well, generally, you have to do it by the end of the disclosure statement hearing. You can do it verbally, or you can do it in writing if you're not attending the hearing. And the court can obviously set an extended time for you. And that's, in many courts, that's not uncommon at all. A good cause might be that you don't know your value or you don't know your claim. So you go to the court and say, Judge, we don't know how to make this decision. We simply don't have the information. It's not enough in the disclosure statement, or we haven't had these hearings. And so you would ask the court to extend your time. Oops. Okay, so if you make the election, you abandon your unsecured claim. So assume I'm a secured creditor. I've got a $1 million allowed claim, and my collateral's worth, say, $700,000. So in that particular instance, I have a $700,000 secured claim under 506, and I have a $300,000 unsecured claim under 506. What 1111B essentially is going to do is take those two claims and put them back together into one secured claim. That claim will be secured by your lien, your pre-existing lien, on whatever collateral interest you had. By the way, I didn't say this, but as we go through this, if you have questions, please just stop me and let's take them as we go, because particularly when we get to the mathematics. 1111B can be pretty counterintuitive, so I'd rather we stop and pause and make sure we clear up whatever I said or didn't say than have you sitting there confused. So the key points of the election are that you've got to make your decision by the disclosure statement. You have to decide by class. So a lot of times people tend to think of themselves only. And in a lot of cases, it is only you in that class, or essentially only you in that class if you're the big unsecured creditor. But it's a class vote, just like every other vote that you would do for a plan. It's two-thirds and one-half. Okay? So you've got to get through those numbers in your class to implement the 1111B election. So it's not simply a single secured creditor that gets to decide. Oops. Okay. So one of the things that occurs under 1111B is that the liens become what I sort of call untouchable. The liens are in effect, they stay in effect. You can't move them, you can't amend them, and there is some pretty good case law and some interesting thoughts about what actually constitutes your lien. We tend to think about things a little bit too simplistically sometimes when we look at these claims, and we need to start, particularly in the context of 1111B, we need to start thinking about these in terms of the rights that go along with your promissory note and your loan agreements versus the rights that are in your liens. So, for example, I had a case a couple years ago where there was a piece of land in downtown Miami, and there were rights that went along with the loan agreement and rights that went along inside of the mortgage. And some of those rights were that without the lender's permission, the borrower could not change the nature of the project. So this was going to be a high-rise office building, and they wanted, during their plan, they wanted to change it to a high-rise condominium. So the question existed, and we scratched our head for a little bit on this, is that a change of the lien, or is that just a change of the notes and the terms? And ultimately, we decided that it was a change of the notes and the term, and it didn't affect the lien. So that's one example. Another example you may run into is if the debtor wants to bifurcate the collateral and sell it off in pieces, but it's under one lien, you have a very good argument under 1111B that says you can't go bifurcating my collateral and selling it off in pieces. And that, as a secured creditor, is a pretty powerful tool that may help you block a plan if you don't want to go along with the plan. Okay. Oops. Yeah. So why do you want to make the election anyway? As I just said, sometimes you want to block a plan, but the other reason is that you may want to go along with the plan, but you want to participate in the upside. You don't want to get crammed down to the value that you're at, the $700,000 in my example a moment ago, thinking that either you have a bad valuation or that the value of the collateral is going to rise dramatically over the next few years. So it allows the secured creditor to participate in that, and that's what the whole Pinegate case was about. And so that's the history and why it's there. As you're doing that, there's a couple of things that come into play. So one is, if the debtor decides to sell its collateral early in the plan, the likelihood of you as a secured creditor under 1111B getting a piece of the upside is higher. The other thing that happens is, at the end of the plan, the balloon payment on the debt will be higher. So if the term is short enough. And we'll go through some mathematical examples with some graphs in a few minutes. But just try to grab hold of those concepts. What you're looking at is early payment generates more proceeds to the secured creditor in general. And the balloon payment at the end, if the term is short enough, will also generate additional proceeds to the secured creditor. Now, if you want to block the plan, some of this becomes a little counterintuitive, as we'll see in a minute. But the higher scheduled payments and the higher balance at the end of the maturity are the two things you're going to look at. So if you have let's just use amortization, for example. if you have a short amortization, your payments will be higher. Right? Everybody with me? Let's say a 10-year versus a 20-year. On a 10-year, your payments are higher because you have to pay it off quicker. Okay? So that makes your balance at maturity higher. That's a harder hurdle to hit. If you stretch that out, you obviously have an easier hurdle. So all these terms come into play as you're trying to get your plan approved. Okay, so here's the 1111B mathematical equation. So if you take 506, everybody got that? I'll just give you a moment to read that. Okay, so it's pretty simple. Most of y'all have higher math degrees because you're lawyers, right? So it is, as I said, a little counterintuitive. There's nothing meaningful there except for I had too much time on my hands. But generally speaking, larger is better. So does anybody know what these numbers are? Wow. All right. So I had to do this. I wasn't coming all the way back home for nothing. So this is our years. Let's move on so I can get out of here safely. Okay. So 1111B. 1111B, when people run the mathematics, the biggest problem I see is that people try to run them together. When you run the mathematics on 1111B or you have someone, an advisor, help you, they need to be done separately. They are two separate tests. Every time I see people try to do all the math in one set of calculations, it doesn't work out. It just becomes confusing. Their spreadsheets are messed up. Run them twice, and they're pretty simple. The first one is the one we always have under 1129, and that is you got to return the present value back to the secured creditor. Right? So we all know what that means. You pay them principal, you pay them interest, you calculate your values. Most of us know how to go on the internet and find something to calculate those values. You're going to run that test like you always do. The second one, I like to call it an add-on, but for some reason that confuses people. But if it works for you, think of the second test as an add-on. Once the election under 1111B is made, you now have what I call the aggregate payment test. Okay? Aggregate payment test is simple. As long as you keep it separated from the other one. You start with your total allowed claim, the biggest number, right, $1 million as we spoke about, and you simply subtract from that the amount of the total payments that the debtor gives to the secured creditor, principal and interest combined. Any dollar that goes to the secured creditor reduces your 1111B balance. That make sense? Everybody want to go out back where the boats are and... Okay, so really this is it right here. If you take these two pieces with you as we go through the next 20 or 30 minutes, you'll see where they come into play, they interact, sometimes they fight with each other, as you're going to see in just a second, and sometimes they work together. There's one other piece to this puzzle, and that is what is your collateral worth, and I talked about that at the beginning. Typically, we'll see 1111B done in single asset real estate cases. This is the most common place. But keep in mind that if you have depreciating collateral and you make the 1111B election, it'll be a very powerful tool as well. Okay, so before we get into the words, the second biggest problem I see is that we don't use our words right. I've, under oath, I think, admitted that I was the world's biggest offender of this. The big problem is that we typically get real loose when we're just talking and we'll say undersecured claim. There's no such thing as an undersecured claim. You're either secured or you're not secured, period, end of story. If you start following that mentality and get rid of undersecured claim, then it all works. And if you don't, the problem is that you're going to have one understanding what those words are, and the person on the other side, the other participants in the plan, won't have the same understanding. You won't be using the same lingo. And I guarantee you, by the time you get through that process, which is already complicated enough, everybody in the room, including your judge, is going to be confused and frustrated because you're not using the same language. So stick to allowed claim and secured claim and undersecured creditor, okay? And then you'll be all right. I also recommend just that you put these definitions into the plan or the disclosure statement. Because there's a lot of people who don't deal with this. And in 1111B, one of the things that happens when you make the election is that the entire claim becomes secured. So your $1 million allowed claim gets redefined as a secured claim. Now, you're thinking, but my secured claim is $700,000. Well, it's not once the election is made because the allowed claim is completely secured by the lien. Does everybody follow that? Because that's one of the tricky parts here. Okay, good. All right, so based on that, you've got these two tests, which gives you four possibilities. You could fail them both. You could pass them both. You could fail one or the other. And so there's four possible outcomes, but at the end of the day, you have to pass them both, which in this little graphic is represented in the lower right-hand corner. Okay, so you got to both give back the present value under 1129, and you've got to also repay the total amount of the allowed claim or the secured claim under 1111B. Okay? Can everybody see that? Is that big enough? Can anybody not see it? Other than Brad in the very back row. Okay. Okay, so I want to run through a few examples. Let's just assume that you have a loan amount, which is your allowed claim, of $110. Your collateral is worth $100. That leaves you with a $10 unsecured claim. Now, assume in this case that the court approves a 5% interest rate and every other confirmation requirement is going to be fulfilled. So the question is, if you don't make the election under that scenario, would it be helpful for those of you on this side to see this on this screen as well? Okay. Does that help? Good. Okay. Okay, so what you have is a situation where you're going to pay $5 in interest, which means a total of $105 is going to get returned to the secured creditor. The problem with that is that there's a $110 allowed claim. And so under 1111B, if you didn't make the election, our normal 506 kind of 1129 standards, there's no problem. If the creditor makes the election, however, you have to make sure, as the debtor, that you return at least $110 of cash payments to the creditor. So in this particular case, there's only $105 going to the creditor. You have an obligation to give them $110. So if the creditor elects 1111, makes the 1111B2 election, then you can't confirm the plan. Okay? So what do you do? In this particular example, you amend the plan term. Make the plan term go 2 years, not 1 year. Okay? So now you're going to pay them $5 of interest per year. So now you've given them a total of $110 of payments, which is your allowed claim obligation, your secured claim obligation under 1111B. And so now you can confirm your plan. Does that work for everybody? Great. Okay. Oops. Okay. So let's take this up a notch now. Remember I told you about the voting. You have 2/3 and 1/2. Okay. So in this particular case, let's think about what happens with your unsecured claim. If you were the secured creditor and you want to block the debtor's plan, would you make the 1111B2 election in this situation? You got your $110 loan, you have a $50 collateral value, you have a typo, which should say you have a $60 collateral value, rather, and you got a $60 secured claim and you got a $50 unsecured claim, okay? There's only one other creditor, okay? So there's $110 of allowed claim, you have $60 secured claim, which means you're going to have a $50 unsecured claim. There's one other unsecured creditor who has a $40 claim. You want to block the plan. Think about your unsecured vote and tell me what you do. Who thinks you would make the election? who thinks you would not make the election? Okay, good. All right, so you wouldn't make the election. Does everybody understand why? That's great. We're going to get to see the boats before we know it. Okay, so here's the mathematics of how it works out. I have my numbers reversed, but the numbers still come into play. You've got 50% of the votes. You've got slightly less than two-thirds majority of the unsecured claims, so you can block, right? All right. Next example for you. You want to block, but now there's five other unsecured creditors, so there's six if you include your unsecured claim. They've got a total of $200. You've got $50. Excuse me, $60. What would you like to do? You want to block the plan. You're going to be the secured creditor in this example. So let me ask it this way. Can you carry the two-thirds number? No, right? You are one out of five, six rather. Okay? So right there on those merits alone, you can't control the unsecured class. So in this particular case, you would strongly consider the election. And here's how the numbers play out. You're one against six. If you take the election, you give it up, but you probably weren't going to carry the class anyway. So now you have the potential to get upside from your claim. And that's what you want to do. All right. See how we're doing on time. I'm going to skip the next two examples, because I'd like to get on to how the math really works with you. Okay. Before we get to the math, let's think about the case strategy here a little bit. What collateral do you have? So I've got a series of slides here, and I don't want to read them to you, but I do want to talk in general about collateral and how it plays out. You need to be thinking about the collateral. If you're the debtor, how much money am I having to spend to keep this collateral alive for the benefit of the likely benefit of the secured creditor? Is the collateral going to appreciate in value or depreciate in value, which is a very big deal? Is this collateral worth more to me or to the lender? In the Miami case that I referenced, it was a very interesting scenario because the mortgage had been purchased by the neighboring property owner. So to that neighboring property owner, the land was actually worth more to that individual than it was to the market as a whole, because they had the potential to combine the two pieces of land and do more with it.
We pause this program for your online CLE codes. Please write down 4-8-7-7-2. Thank you.
One of the things that will come into play as you're trying to get your plan confirmed is the fair and reasonableness standard. So a lot of times you see terms, and this is a know your judge kind of thing, but a lot of times you'll see terms that just, you know, you look at them and you go, you just sort of shake your head and go, how can that be? You know, the interest rate is too long, the amortization is too long, the loan term is too long, all those sorts of things. So it's not as simple as saying, oh, I'll make the election, I can make feasibility harder, because you have to sort of get into the mind of your judge and decide how that whether or not the judge might approve those terms anyway. And some judges, I'm not sure why, to be frank, but some judges, once the 1111B election is made, believe or seem to believe that it sort of opens up the gates for them to have a different standard. You'll see that in a few cases where, for example, there's one case out there where a judge approved a 40-year term. You know, sort of unheard of, a 40-year amortization, actually a 40-year term with a balloon, excuse me. So some of the results that are out there in some of the courts can be kind of scary if you're a secured creditor and you make this election. So you need to know your judge and try to understand what the likelihood of them making those judgments are for you. Okay. So at the end of the plan, you've got a payoff balance, right? Whether it's a normal 1129 plan or not. So what I tell people to do is oftentimes look at their appraisal reports, if it's a piece of real estate, and look, if they do a discounted cash flow in that real estate appraisal, look at the number they have at the far right-hand corner, which is the value that they're going to sell the property for in, say, year 10, whatever the end of your appraisal is, and then compare that number to your payoff balance. Because sometimes the evidence you need is already there. Does that make sense? Got a couple odd stares. Trish always looks at me funny, but a couple odd stares. Because at the end of a discount cash flow, your appraiser is projecting the value, or their appraiser, depending which side, they're projecting a value for you, and they're discounting that value back to the present day, but they're telling you what the expected sales price is. Now, lots of times that doesn't occur, and it depends on your type of case, but if it's an equipment case, you're probably not going to have that. But what you can do in some of these other cases, especially the real estate cases, is you can look at the capitalization rates and you can look at the loan-to-value. So what I put in a lot of my reports, for example, is the capitalization rate. And I'll know what the cash flow is going to be in the year 10. It's already going to be projected by me or an appraiser or somebody or the debtor. You can just do a capitalization. And I realize that a lot of you would hire someone to do that for you. But a lot of the answers are there. And maybe some of the takeaway here is, don't be too scared of 1111B. Hire somebody to help you go dig those numbers out or find those numbers or calculate those numbers. And then if the plan says we're going to sell it or we're going to refinance it, there's history out there. And the ones that are up on the board are for lodging properties, hotels, right? So I can go back and I can see what the loan-to-value has been. Like the bottom graph there is the loan-to-value of the last 10 years for hotels. That's data I keep every day. So I can go back and I can calculate it, and I can make a very educated decision and say to a judge, look, the loan-to-value has varied between, 65 and 75% for the last 10 years. I don't have any reason to think that that's not going to hold true. It's a fairly reasonable assumption. Let's do the math, and let's see if they can refinance it. And then you come up with some reasonable opinion, hopefully. Same with amortization periods. Those numbers are out there. They're out there in the for people who know are in the business I'm in, those numbers are out there. You can find them. A lot of people don't know where to look, but they're out there, and you can make yourself a nice case and a nice argument using those. Okay. So a little case strategy for you. If you're a debtor, you might want to consider finding a way to create, loosely worded, of course, a class that's going to be impaired and accept, right? Because you need an impaired accepting class. So if you can maybe, and I don't know how this would work here, but if you can create a convenience class, for example, who's likely going to take it but be impaired, or find another friendly creditor that's willing to be impaired and still vote for you, you will essentially take away a lot of the power that 1111B gives to the secured creditor. And then the bottom one is you can always lengthen your plan term to try to make your plan more feasible. You run into the fair and reasonable problem, but at the same time, it may be the only way to get a balance that you can reasonably pay off. Oops. So if you're a secured creditor, we went through a little bit of this, but if you're willing to do it, you want to stay in. 1111B is a tremendously powerful tool to bring everybody to the table to talk about cutting a deal. I mean, just the mere threat of having to go to discuss 1111B and all the numbers and the options and the confusion that will cause in court, where you literally have people standing around going, "Well, I think that's how it works." It's a really good tool to have a conversation. So maybe you're unwilling. You got a chance to block through voting, or you can block through the feasibility. Okay. Now, 1111B has a big impact on feasibility. And this may be a little small. Is that readable? Okay, good. All right, so the first column I have labeled debt service coverage ratio, DSCR. Okay, so that's the feasibility that you've got to hit on an ongoing sort of monthly, yearly basis, right? You've got to be able to make your payments. The debt service coverage ratio is an indicator of how easy and how much comfort and breathing room a debtor will have over its payments. Now, some of this is counterintuitive. The next column, just keeping with this real quickly, is your typical 1129 payoff. That's what you would owe them when the balloon matures. And then the last one is the 1111B. Okay, 1111B, start with the allowed claim amount, subtract out each payment. Okay, so as a secure creditor, you always want your interest rate higher, right? Would everybody agree? As a secure creditor, you always want your term shorter, right? Anybody?
Yes.
Thank you, Roy. And how about your amortization? Did I mention that one? Do you want your, as a lender, you want your amortization longer or shorter?
Shorter.
Shorter. You want to get your money back, right? Okay, so now here's where the counterintuitive part of 1111B starts to fight with 1129. If you raise your interest rate, for example, your payments are higher. If your payments are higher, you reduce your 1111B balance more quickly. Everybody follow that? Allow a claim, subtract out each payment. So if you're reducing your 1111B balance more quickly, you just made it easier for the debtor to hit its plan. You just made it easier for the debtor to prove feasibility at the balloon period because they have a lower balance, because you raised the interest rate on them, and each one of those interest payments went to reducing their payoff. Sort of counterintuitive, right? So the question exists, how much do you want to fight for a high interest rate if you're the secured creditor in a plan that you're trying to defeat on the back end for feasibility? You want to show that they have a very high balance, that they're very unlikely to be able to pay you off at the end of the plan term. So it's counterintuitive. The same with amortization. If you shrink the amortization, the payments are higher, and your 1111B balance at the payoff will be lower. This is probably where I'm going to start to lose people. Does anybody want to discuss that?
No. I'm not sure I follow that. So, first, the allowed claim, that's what the amount of the entire amount of secure credit to.
Yes.
And that's kind of the goal here with 1111B, is that now it's made that. And then you have the value of their collateral, which you're talking about the traditional 1129 calculation. Is it your experience that when a debtor tries to satisfy a secured claim where the creditor made the 1111 election, that the creditor pays the normal 1129 calculation and then pays in a lump sum at the end of that the difference between the allowed claim and the secured claim, they pay that in a lump sum, and that's what you're referring to as the 1111B?
Yes, with an asterisk next to it. Over time, your 1111B balance will actually get reduced to below your 1129 balance. It just doesn't matter where they crash. I'm going to show you that in just a second. In fact, why don't we just jump right there? Okay. Here's the answer to your question. So the graph up there is your normal 1129 payments. This is what happens, right? You've got interest, so it's not a nice straight line down because you got to make your interest payments. So, and this is the 360 represents 360 months in this example. I don't know if I can carry this over there. So what you have going on here is this slow decline, just like a home mortgage, for example, that everybody's familiar with, a slow decline of your payoff, right? Everybody with me? Under 1111B, what you have is something that looks more like this, because you are incrementally taking level payments amounts. Interest doesn't matter. 100% of everything you make, and let's say you got a $10,000 per month payment, you're reducing that by the same amount. And so what you end up with is two different lines on the graph, two different shaped lines on the graph. The next piece of the puzzle, of course, is your collateral value. If you've got collateral that's appreciating value, and notice that this started at 700,000. At the end of the term, you've got to pay that off. So you got to so you're going to calculate what your value is worth at the end, and you might have collateral just depreciating. And so you may have a curve like this. Now, if you put all those curves together, I'm going to walk over here. If y'all can't hear me, just shout at me.
Okay, so the blue line is how quickly your normal 1129 balance is being paid off. The red line is your 1111B balance, and the top green line is what your collateral curve. Where the two lines, the red and the blue line, lie, your payoff is the same. Where the red line is, over on this side of the chart, where the red line is, that's where the 1111B balance would give more money back to the secured creditor. Over here, you would take the higher of the two numbers, because it is the test of the two sets of numbers, so that you would pay off the secured creditor based on the blue line. Now, all that said, there's a point in time, right about here, which I think corresponds to about month 60, where your collateral value and your 1111B,
and your 1111B value correspond. So at that point in time, you basically could sell the collateral, pay off your balance, and be done. Alternatively, you can stretch the term out, and the difference in the distance between the green line and whichever is the top line at that point, either the red or the blue, will be the amount of money you bring back to the estate. Did that answer your question?
Yes, that's very helpful.
Did I confuse everybody else, though? Okay. How about any questions about this? Because this is really how the math works, and it's a little bit confusing because you sort of switch in midstream, right? At this inflection point where the blue and the red line cross, you've got to put on a different hat and go, wait a minute, I've got to think about what the higher balance is between these two. So at any point here, back here, you've got to pay off the higher number of 1111B, and that's why this is a favorite of the secured creditor. And then out at this point, it doesn't really matter anymore. So the longer the term you can have as the debtor, the better off you'll be in terms of how all those numbers collide. Well, that said, if you have, let's see if I have it. If you have a value that is depreciating, make this, let me go to the screen over here for a moment. Maybe. All right. There we go. Keep bear with me 1 second.
Frank, while you're doing that, is that the big unknown is the green line? Where is the collateral going to go? I don't know if we've seen the bottom of the recession. We don't know. I presume things are going up in value, it holds the same. Maybe they're not going to go down anymore.
Right.
You don't know, and obviously usually the debtor has a more optimistic view of the future.
Oh, no, I know. You don't know. I know. Yeah. No, I'm just teasing you. Of course, that's true, but you do know certain things about certain collateral, right? Let's say that your debtor is a printing company, and they've got a $1 million printing press. Okay, the world-class printing press worth $1 million. We know that that printing press doesn't last forever. In fact, we know by, all common sense maybe that printing press is only going to last 10 years. So that's a depreciating asset, unlike, most real estate assets, which during most of their life will appreciate. So if you, let's see if I can get this pulled together here. If you look at the lines over here, this is essentially what we have on the far side, but that's growth of the collateral value. Now, if we have one that's declining in value, you see how this green line just shifted down and compare it to the other side? So this is a depreciating asset. This is your printing press. The other line is, say, your real estate property. So now what happens is your value of your property is lower than your 1129 balance, and up to this point, it's lower than your 1111B balance. So that's what I was trying to say earlier, that if your asset is depreciating in value,
from a feasibility standpoint, you've got to come in and try to prove that your asset has now got enough value at the end of your plan. If your plan ended out here, you've got to come back and prove that your asset has enough value to retire the claim, and it doesn't in this line. So the real estate cases, I think, are probably easier than, say, the equipment cases or other collateral that you might have that would depreciate in value. Okay? Does that follow? Any questions about that? Okay. I'm going to change a couple of these numbers. Because what you're doing is you're setting the debtor up to prove that feasibility. Remember, the secured creditor makes the election. That's going to make it darn near impossible for a debtor to prove feasibility. So if you want to defeat the plan, you make the 1111B election, and then your 1111B numbers are higher. Now you're right. I mean, in some ways you're right, right? You've always got your 1129 issue, but you've created a lien problem too for them. You're throwing all kinds of darts at them because let's say that they've got not one piece of equipment, but 10 pieces of equipment all under one lien. They can't go sell off pieces of equipment. You're really creating a very strong blocking issue by doing that. Okay, so I just want to kind of show the relationship here for a second. All right, this is set up with a 30-year amortization, okay? Let me see if I can fix this graph real quickly. All right, that's better. Okay, so we talked about some of these things being counterintuitive, right? So here's a 30-year amortization. I'm going to go ahead and make this a appreciating asset again. We'll let it appreciate it at 1.5% a year, okay? So that's our line. We're back to where we were. Now, the lender says, normally, I want my money back faster. I want a quicker amortization. So what does that do when we do that? We'll change from a 20 to a 30-year amortization. Well, the lines grew closer, right? So what you want to do is you want to create hard payoffs at the end. You want that 1129 balance to be way up there. You want the 1111B balance to be more difficult. Sorry, this was set up. Actually, it's actually a good example. This is set up, and this is why 1111B matters. The loud claim and your secure claim are the same right here at the beginning. Okay, you got $1 million, and that's why they start at the same point. And that's why over-secured creditors don't get the 1111B election. There's really no reason. They're starting from the same point. So let's go back to our example that I had been talking about. At 700,000. Oops. Apparently. Okay. Okay, so you see the red line is now at 700,000. It begins, that's your 1111B balance. And your, oh, actually the colors are reversed here. The, one second. The amortization here, if we switch that from a 30 to a 20, you can see, everybody see how the red line become much more up and down? It's paying off the balance faster with a shorter amortization. Okay? So the question is, where is your collateral value going to be in relation to that? So right here, until the collateral value rises above the 1129 balance in that example, and I should put this back at $1 million for you, but until our collateral value rises above the amount, you can't confirm the plan. You don't have enough equity. And it's kind of like, why would you? Because why would you go through, and this is one of the things that comes into play, why would you go through all of that for, do all that work for the sake of the secured creditor is one of the things that comes to mind for a lot of the debtors. There you go. That's more correct. So does that flow? Does any questions about that? Did I confuse everybody? Just you?
early. But my question is, if you make the election, you are converting to a principal-only loan. You have no chance of ever getting in.
No. You're keeping the you're adding to it. And don't under 1111B, it's not principal only. It's every dollar you give to the secured creditor reduces your 1111B balance. So you have two separate tests. You have your normal test, the 1129, you know, principal and interest sort of test. And then you have this other one where you just start with the allowed claim, and then you subtract out the amount of payments that you give them.
I'm thinking it's the creditor. I'm owed $1 million, and all I'm going to get is $1 million, and I'm not going to give any interest or any addition to that under any circumstance.
Why wouldn't you get interest under 1129?
Well, if I'm fully secured, I'm owed under 1129, but I'm asking about 1111B. Under 1111B, if I make the election, from then on, I get my full claim as of that day, but no interest, no additions. I'm going to get exactly that amount over some period of time.
Well, I think the way to – did everybody hear that? He's saying that – or asking the question whether or not you get interest. Do you just really – if you look at the red line, he's saying you're really just getting the red line, okay? And that's true until the red line and the blue line cross, at which point you get a higher amount than you would otherwise. If you're just getting the payments on the red line, you would get a lower amount here. At this point, the inflection point, you're starting to get higher payments than you would under 1111B.
Right, but if I elect 1111B, all I'm going to get is whatever my claim is the day I make that election, period, or the petition. I'm not switching back and forth. I'm just asking, under 1111B, you are converting it to a principal-only note over some period of time.
No, what you're doing is 506 is reducing your allowed claim or bifurcating your allowed claim into the two pieces. You're marrying those two pieces back. So your interest is paid on the $700,000 in our example, and that's where your payments will be calculated from. They will start reducing from your 1111B balance, which is a separate table. So you are going to get interest on your $700,000. You're not going to get it on your million. Does that get us on the same page? Yeah, you don't get interest on your 1111B balance. You get it on your 1129 balance.
Even though I've made the election to 1111B.
Even though you made the election. The 1111B just gives you an extra opportunity during your case to get some more money back or an extra opportunity to block feasibility. So with that, I got 2 minutes left. One of the things that I found fascinating in this I was sitting on a panel with Judge Zive, who's from Reno, and there's nothing in this that says if you make the 1111B election that you vote no for the plan. It's sort of assumed that if you make the 1111B election, you're voting no for the plan. But the reality is, and Judge Zive actually had this happen, was that you as a creditor could make the 1111B election and then vote yes for the plan. So why would you do that? Well, you preserved your upside. You don't want to own the collateral, but you want to maximize your numbers. So you could go cut a deal with the debtor, maybe get more, maybe more than you were going to get, because maybe the debtor's willing to buy your vote, because they're going to impair you, right? Buy your vote, you get the 1111B, and you retain the upside. Keeps the debtor more in control, if you will, if you're the secured creditor. But opens up a whole nother line of negotiating a better deal for both parties.
We pause this program for your online CLE codes. Please write down 1, 4, 2, 9, 6. Thank you.
So, with that, I think I'm done. Thank you.